Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz, together with my compatriot, Brendan Berry. We are both professors of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. And before we commence, I have to say that the opinions that Brendan and I share on this show are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty as a whole. Good morning, Brendan.
Well, we're going to have opinions. We're supposed to have opinions. Is that it? You never have opinions, Jeff, about anything.
I am one of the least opinionated people you will ever meet.
Yeah.
I love that.
So, yeah.
That's probably the funniest thing I've ever said. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And the biggest lie you've ever told. That's.
I don't think that's a lie. I don't lie. I don't lie.
Right.
I don't lie.
Oh, that's right.
I may be. I didn't say I was. I said I may be. You may know some
okay.
people who are more opinionated than
okay.
I am.
You hedged.
Okay.
All right, I got it.
I hedge my bets. That's why I go to Vegas.
The question is, Professor, are you going to be able to prove what you just said?
I will never be able to prove that. I literally will never be able to prove that, okay? Because whether someone is opinionated or not is what? An opinion. So this
correct.
Oh, God.
Okay, I don't really want to spend a lot of time beating that dead horse. Okay.
Yeah, right.
We'll just sort of leave it at that one. I win. Okay.
Yeah, okay, you win. Move on. Let's go.
I just won in the top of the 11th, like the Yankees yesterday. By the way, congratulations to all the Yankee fans. I happen to be one of them. They're really playing very good baseball. I think they've now won 8 in a row. I'm not hearing – I watch Morning Joe. I listen to Joe Scarborough, who's a big Boston Red Sox fan.
Yeah.
And some of his Boston Red Sox compatriots, and they really get on Willie Geist all the time because he's a Yankee fan. I've not heard any of that for the past week or so as the Boston Red Sox continue to dive in the standings and the Yankees keep going up. So it's going to be fun to watch the rest of the baseball season. But I'm a Yankee fan. I'm really glad they're playing well. And when they get some of their pitchers back, it may be a foregone conclusion that they will be in the playoffs, and that always makes a Yankee fan happy. So there we go. That's really not what I think about that. We start every show with a segment we call So What Do You Really Think? And today I'm basically going to go for some low-hanging fruit here, and we've got a lot of very serious stuff to talk about, but I'm going to go for some real low-hanging fruit here. There's a judge, the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit. Her name is Beryl Howell. And Beryl has brought to light something that a lot of us probably really weren't paying much attention to. And that is that the people who have been arrested and charged in the insurrection of January 6th are, you know, responsible for the damages that they caused, not whether they did it directly, but whether it was done in concert with other people. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, so far, the Capitol rioters apparently have only been sentenced to pay up to $1.5 million individually, like $500 at a time or $2,000 at a time for their convictions. The problem is that at this point, the government has had a loss in the billions of dollars. And for whatever the reasons are, the government really isn't going after these people for this restitution. And like what the Judge Beryl said, my experience and knowledge of federal court is that the government goes after very aggressively all of the defendants I've ever seen for restitution, for investigative services, for damages directly related to the victim, or by municipalities, whoever it is that has suffered all these damages. And for some reason or another, the federal government is not being aggressive in this context. It's bad enough that they're letting these people off with probationary periods and $500 fines, and one guy who's committed serious offenses gets 8 months in jail. And I went on and on about that a couple of weeks ago. But crippling these people financially will probably prevent them from traveling around the country causing trouble again.
Mm.
It's crippling them, literally crippling them with restitution. And if they don't fulfill their restitution, taking civil judgments and grabbing everything you can get your hands on. We do it with IRS. Why aren't we doing it here? Enough is enough. Letting these people off light discourages no one from doing anything. It's 70 years ago, 80 years ago, Hitler stood up, 90 years ago actually now, 90 years, 100? 100 years ago. Hitler stood up in front of a court in Germany after having committed real treason, an armed insurrection, a true armed insurrection, charged with treason, and blamed everybody but himself for what happened. And the judges bought it, and instead of saving the world by hanging him up on a rope, they gave him 5 years in prison, and he was out in 8 months while he dictated Mein Kampf.
Mm-hmm.
And paid nothing for the people who died. Enough. You cannot make friends with people by being light on them, these people who commit insurrection and try to destroy your government. If you're not going to put them in jail, put them in financial prison. Every dime they have that it doesn't take to put a roof over their head and food in their mouths should be going back to paying back the American government the half a million, if not more, half a billion, if not more, in damages that were done to our capital, to the police officers who died, and to the police officers and the expenses it took to investigate them, to charge them, to prosecute them. And they're paying $500? That's ridiculous. That was what was proposed to be charged for noisemakers on Miami Beach with their boom boxes. Enough. Put them in financial prison. Give them no ability to travel around the country making trouble. Teach them a lesson. Pay us back as if you can return the lives of those who eventually died or took their own lives because of your actions. And that's what I think about that.
Yeah, I mean, how much do you suppose it costs, you know, I mean, just to take a minor component of the cost that they imposed on this country, how much do you suppose it costs to put that fencing around the Capitol grounds? Right, layers of fencing around the Capitol, around the White House. How much did it cost in tourism, right, to D.C.? I mean, that alone. To say nothing of, right, the people who died and whatnot. It seems we've lost our focus on Jeff. In a former life, I used to teach criminal law. Jeff teaches criminal law now, and one of the things we teach is purposes, right, of punishment, theories of punishment. And, of course, one of the major goals of sentencing, especially in a case where it's a high-profile case, is deterrence. And, yeah, seeking a few hundred dollars from each one of these people, it doesn't seem to me is going to get the job done. And it also fits a pattern. And I've got to talk a little bit about what Jeff said before I get to my own, what I really think. But I don't understand the lack of aggression in general on the part of the federal government. And this particularly is the case, of course, when it's under the control of a Democratic administration. Jeff and I were talking earlier this morning about another episode that shows the lack of aggressiveness on the part of this government when it comes to dealing with the issues that we absolutely have to deal with. It's now come to light in the news yesterday that now we're going to have to wait at least until November for Congress to get Donald Trump's tax returns. Why? Because Donald Trump, of course, ran to court to try to stop that from happening. So the Department of Justice issued a ruling, I think it was last week, saying that the Department of Treasury should immediately turn over, that there was no legal
not
reason
should,
not to.
Not should, not
yeah,
should,
must,
Brendan, must.
Must immediately turn over the requested documents, which of course were Donald Trump's tax returns and tax information, to congressional committees that had requested them, the Ways and Means Committee in particular. Why, when that order came down from the Department of Justice, why there wasn't a vehicle already backed up to the Department of Treasury building to take those boxes of documents right over to the Capitol and dump them in the offices of the Ways and Means Committee staff before Donald Trump even had a chance to think about litigating the case is beyond me. If Republicans, if you just think about the way Republicans do things, if Republicans had been running this show and an order had come down from the Department of Justice, let's say saying Hillary Clinton's records about Hillary Clinton have to be immediately turned over to a congressional committee, they would have turned those records over before anybody could have litigated the case. But no, they drag their feet, right? This is kind of the way Democrats do things. Well, we're going to have to dot our I's and cross our T's take your time about it. And so what happens? You get a judge involved, and now there's a delay in turning over those materials. We've got to get aggressive. And we can talk more about that later.
Yeah, what's funny in that particular instance, it's not funny, I say funny weird, not funny, ha-ha, is the idea that the judge bought into Trump's lawyers being allowed to take discovery, take depositions and other discovery in regards to this. There is nothing to discover. The
right.
statute doesn't make way for Congress having to explain itself. If Congress wanted to have to explain itself, it would have put it in the statute. There are no exceptions in the statute. There is no case law to support what they're arguing. But they want to take depositions of Congress, of members of the Ways and Means Committee, as to why they're asking for this stuff.
Right.
First
and just
of all,
to be clear,
they have congressional immunity. They don't have to explain themselves.
Right. And just to be clear about what the statute says, it says that when the chair of the Ways and Means Committee
the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee.
Right. When that person requests somebody's tax documents, the Treasury shall produce the documents. That's all it says, unless I'm mistaken. Right?
Right. And if in interpreting that, the DOJ tells Congress, you must immediately do this. There's only one word for immediately that I know, a word to describe the word immediately. Right now. 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 Okay. I don't know of any other word that describes immediately. I've had this discussion with a judge once. When I was practicing law and someone came in and asked for a jury trial on a small claims case, and I pointed to the statute that says if he asks for a jury trial, you shall summon a veneer immediately or veneer immediately. That means people to choose from to be the jury. And I stood there and said, I'm ready for trial, Judge. The minute he filed this, I was ready for trial. We pick a jury now. We go downtown and we pick a jury now. And the judge finally had to concede that that was true, and off downtown we went. By the way, they settled. But they weren't ready for the jury trial. Okay.
Yeah, right.
But now is the word. And I don't understand the delay by IRS. They had to have this stuff in boxes ready to deliver. Give me a break.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had to have all these boxes ready. All they got to do is send over a moving van. And I mean a real live moving van probably to move all this stuff. Okay, enough of that. So I agree with you. There is a real lack of aggressiveness here. And we can go on with this about the lack of aggressiveness in, at this point, now having the President of the United States, former President of the United States, say and having said exactly what his intent was for January 6th. There is no question. So I'm sorry. I know he used to be president, but we got to indict him and put him in front of a jury in D.C. Lots of luck getting an acquittal on that one. So there's a lot of lack of aggressiveness here. They're just taking too long to do the things that need to be done.
Right.
And it's not like the evidence isn't out there for them.
Right.
So it's time to convene a secret grand jury and start indicting the real heads of this, like Meadows and Trump and Kushner and all the other people who were deeply, Donald Jr., all of whom were deeply involved in the creation of this insurrection, and put them on trial. I mean, it's that simple. Just put them on trial and convict them.
Yeah. I mean,
enough.
Yeah, it seems like Democrats have a hard time with the concepts of speed and urgency. I remember thinking too, you know, what if the night of the insurrection, right, when everybody was on fire, even Lindsey Graham had said, "I've had enough of this." That very night, Nancy Pelosi should have said that very night before they went home. After we're done with the Electoral College count, the official Electoral College count, immediately, right now, as you point out, right now, tonight, or this morning, early morning, we will convene a special session of the House of Representatives and impeach Donald Trump tonight and send articles of impeachment to the Senate. why they waited for months after that is beyond me, because then you give these Republicans a chance, right, to obfuscate, mm-hmm. to come up with stories, to invent conspiracy theories. You know, it was Antifa, the FBI did it. You give Lindsey Graham time to cool off and come back around, or you give Donald Trump time to corral his people again. Why did they wait? I don't know. anyway, we're far afield. I still haven't gotten
to
what I really think. Let me
why don't you tell me what you really think?
But I want to tell you an email I felt compelled to write to my sister yesterday, and I'll bring this around to why I'm talking about it. I had planned to go to Washington, D.C. for the first time in a couple of years on August 20th, so 10 days from now. So I still may. But that obviously would be, there's a reason why it's been a couple of years. I have not been on an airplane. Not one of those people who was anxious to do that. But I decided I would do it. I booked that trip a couple months ago. I love going to Washington, D.C. I love seeing my family. I have my sister and her husband and their two boys who are 12 and 10. Here's the email I had to write last night. Hey, please let me know if you'd like me to postpone my trip. If you want me to still come up there, I will. But I completely understand if you don't want someone coming from Ron DeSantis's Florida on a flight where we're all breathing in the Delta variant, coming into a home with an unvaccinated child. The next sentence is so full of expletives that I'm not going to read it. And it's, at any rate, please know that I'm flexible. So one of my sister's kids is vaccinated. The other is not yet eligible to be vaccinated. This is an email I would not have had to write if Republicans had not governed in this country. And I want to make the point again, a couple of points, actually. Number one is that elections have consequences. We've talked about this before, but I'm going to say it again. I don't ever want to hear anybody say that again. Well, I'm not going to vote. Doesn't matter who wins. They're all the same. Elections have consequences. Our choices have consequences. The election of Donald Trump is now going over 600,000 consequences, just in terms of COVID alone, right?
Yeah, right.
And Ron DeSantis, the election of Ron DeSantis, is the reason why the Delta variant, the presence of that person, a Trumpster, Trump-lite, the presence of that person in the governor's mansion is the reason why I may not be able to go see my family. And that's a consequence that I take seriously. People say, I don't want to get the vaccine. I don't want to wear a mask. You can't make me. People are claiming that even private businesses can't, a restaurant or a concert venue or you can't make me prove that I'm vaccinated. You can't make me wear a mask. It all comes down to, and here's kind of a serious constitutional point. I don't think that at least 30% of Americans have enough of a grasp on what our founders clearly understood. Our founders were big students, if you will. They studied John Locke and the philosophy of John Locke, political philosophy of John Locke. The whole underpinning, the whole idea of government and self-governance, but establishing a government over the people to govern, is something called the social compact, which I think most of us take seriously. If we're going to participate in society, we enter into a certain compact or agreement or understanding with one another. Locke would put it this way, in a state of nature, as he put it, a person is supreme over themselves. I'm my own government. I have nobody over me telling me what to do. What I do is what I want to do. I'm the master of my own universe. The question is, why would you give that up? Why would you voluntarily give that up and enter into a society where there is actually a government telling you things like how fast you're allowed to drive, right, or taking taxes from you? Why would you do that? And the answer is that in a state of nature, according to Locke, right, in a state of nature, yeah, you're the master of your own universe, but it's a dangerous, dangerous universe. Not everyone around you is concerned with equity and justice. And dangers emerge. Other people want what you have. Other conditions arise that threaten your life, your liberty, and your property. And for that reason, we enter into a compact under which we agree, each one of us, to give up some of our own freedom for the common good. There are things that we cannot accomplish one person at a time. You can't fight wars that way, right? Everybody stand outside with your pea shooter, right, to fend off an invading army. We need to come together for the common defense. We need to come together to build infrastructure. There are things that, again, the public good, the common good, that must be accomplished together. And we give up that quantum, if you will, of freedom that is necessary, not more than is necessary, not more, but just that enough of our freedoms to do certain things to accommodate the common good, to save us all, for crying out loud. And people can't get that idea through their heads. No, you do not have a constitutional right to do whatever you want. We're a society. All of us are part of a social compact. That's what I really think.
You know, I can, my mother and father taught me something when I was very young that is basically everything you just said in one statement. and that is, what is good for the country is good for me. And the idea being, as Locke put it, that you are better off being part of the group. And when you are part of the group, being part of the country, giving up something, what is good for everybody around you ultimately is good for you. And it's that simple. And when you put it in those terms, and you and some people say, no, what's good for the country isn't good for me, then they're just operating from a wrong thought process, because the better things get for everybody, the better it is for you. My mother used to say, I don't mind paying my taxes.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's a prerequisite to paying income taxes. You have to make money.
Right.
So what's the problem? The more money I make, the better off I am. I share with the government. I make things better for the country, which ultimately comes all the way around and is good for me. Whether it's taxes and money or whether it's just peace, whatever it may be. So I happen to agree with you on this. I mean, they just don't. Your constitutional rights to freedom, and freedom, by the way, is not in the Constitution. That word is nowhere in the Constitution. Your freedom ends at interfering with my constitutional rights. That's where your freedom ends.
Right. Yeah, your right to swing your fist ends at my nose.
Right, exactly. You can swing it all you want to, but when you hit me, that changes everything. And I agree with that. So it brings me to one of the subjects we were going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to start with this story because I find this just found this fascinating, this story. There was a guy, and I say was for a reason, there was a guy named Dick Farrell who did a radio show, on a conservative station in West Palm Beach, Florida, where a guy that I used to work with at a radio station up in Ohio many years ago actually worked. His name was Lee Fowler. And he was one of the craziest guys I know, and then turned into this just ultimate right-wing conspiracy theorists before we even knew what they were. And he called Dr. Fauci a power-tripping, lying freak in regards to the idea of people getting vaccinated and mask-wearing and everything having to do with COVID-19. Well, I think you can guess the reason why I said there was a guy by the name of Dick Farrell, who was 65 years old, was because Mr. Farrell contracted the disease that he denied existed and that Fauci warned him about, and died. And when he was dying, he changed his tune, and he basically put out a statement urging all of his friends, he didn't care about his enemies, all of his friends to get vaccinated. And he referred to it that he thought it was a scam, what he referred to as a scamdemic. Not one elected Democrat ever tested positive, which was a lie. He called masks face diapers and face panties. And went on and on about this. All things that could have saved his life. And in this case, I would say his worthless life. And yet he dies. Which moves us on to one of my favorite people that we mentioned earlier, Governor Moron Death Santis. Okay. And he is the king of minority politics. And when I say minority politics, I'm talking about the minority controlling the majority. And one of my big problems now with everything that's going on is that, as usual, Democrats, liberals, people who are not prepared to pull out their AR-15s and blow people away because it seems like fun. It is time for those citizens who act responsibly and are either vaccinated or if they can't be vaccinated, they are masked up to stand up and assert your constitutional law or constitutional rights against a vocal, selfish, and probably incredibly stupid minority. The majority of people in this country are now fully vaccinated. Over 70% of the people who are eligible in this country have had at least one shot. They've been poked. And it's time for people like moron DeSantis and the people of the state of Florida to stand up against his thought process, his narcissism, his thought process that the death of people in this country is a good thing. The death of, and I'm talking about the whole country because Florida is infecting everybody. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Now he is telling, because he really can't send out police officers to enforce a no mask, a no mask mandate thought process, and he can't really enforce it. Now he's going to enforce it by telling superintendents of school systems, in Florida, those are countywide, county school superintendents, that you're not going to get paid if you do this. We're going to take your money away. He thinks if he makes it personal about their money, they will throw away their thought processes and their ideals. Well, guess what? They're doing it anyway. Their thoughts are, I make so much money, you don't think I have money in the bank to live off of? If you take my paycheck away? Take my paycheck away. I'm looking out for my students. Next thing you know, he's going to tell principals and teachers, we're not going to pay if your school mandates masks. Don't you dare save a life. Don't you dare protect our children. I want in 2024 to be able to point at Joe Biden and say this was his fault. He promised you things that he'd wipe out the disease, and now it's worse than ever as it mutates again. It's his fault. It's not my fault. It's his fault. And he thinks people will look at all the dead bodies and sick children and say, this is Joe Biden's fault. It's not, moron. It's your fault. It's your fault. And the idea, first of all, he's been beat up in court by Norwegian Cruise Lines and the 11th Circuit, which stayed the order from the Jacksonville court. The Miami court ruled in favor of the cruise lines. But the Jacksonville court, state court or federal court, ruled against the cruise lines. And the 11th Circuit, of all circuits, by the way, the most conservative circuit in the entire country, issued a stay. And if they issued a stay on that order from the district court, there's a reason why circuit courts do that. It's called, I think the other side's going to win.
Right.
Okay. So he's getting beat up in court. And he said, if you want to mandate masks, you have to go, I'm standing up against you. Well, there was a guy in Alabama who did that at the University of Alabama to keep blacks from registering. And guess what? They sent in the National Guard, and they federalized them and said, get out of the way. Now, that's not going to happen here. But he's got to get out of the way. I think that Biden had it right. If you're not going to help, get out of the way. And it just boggles the mind. I mean, I just cutting funding for schools and for school administrators because they won't do your political bidding. You're not looking out for the people of this state, moron DeSantis. You're just rallying your base. And that's enough.
Yeah.
It's enough.
The whole mindset. The whole mindset. I saw a doctor on TV last night who drew a line from this issue to another one that, on its face, they look like two different issues, but her point was they're really not. So, we've got this Delta variant. God only knows what variant's coming next. As you said, I mean, mutations can get even worse than this. So we got this thing running rampant through the country. She said, let's also ask the question, how did it get to be 119 degrees in Oregon, in Portland, Oregon?
They were burning wood.
One would have hoped that that would have been the reason, okay, why it was 119 degrees in Portland, Oregon. But you know the real reason, and so do I.
They were burning forests. What can I tell you?
Yeah, right. That's what I would expect to hear from some of the types we're talking about here. But I get frustrated because for years I've been looking at what's going on in the Republican Party, and it's not just that they're a little bit off, right, on some issues, but not just that we sort of disagree around the edges about certain issues. It's that everything is actually its own opposite. This should be a simple question. Hey, there's a lot of scientists, 99% of them, climate scientists, who say the Earth is getting too warm. And we
Let alone NASA.
Let alone NASA, right? So, and by the way, we think there's a good probability. Now, maybe, again, there's a couple percent chance that this isn't true. Scientists, they like to hedge a little bit. But it's not a possibility, very high probability that humans contribute to it. So the answer to that should be, A, reduce our reliance on fossil fuels to the extent possible, or B, accelerate the problem. Drill, baby, drill, as Sarah Palin would say, right? And what do Republicans decide the right answer?
Sarah who?
Drill, baby. Yeah, right.
Sarah who?
Yeah, Sarah.
Sarah
I know,
who?
I wish I could forget. I wish I could forget.
It only took us 14 years and we forgot who she was. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. Oh, God. But, yeah, I mean, drill more is the answer to the climate change problem. What's the answer to gun violence? Well, more guns. More guns. Right.
Yeah,
because
if everybody has guns, no one will use them, right?
Right. Yeah, that's great theory. And I even looked at, back when this was happening, the Iraq war. I thought, well, let's look at this question. We know who attacked us on 9/11. We know where they are. Right. It's Al Qaeda, and they're in Afghanistan. Right, that's where they're hiding out. We should A, finish them off, or B, invade Iraq. And Republicans picked B. I don't understand. And now we have a pandemic. So naturally, we have a virus that is spreading across the country. Okay, we should A, all wear masks and get vaccinated until we have this thing under control, or B, behave like Ron DeSantis, Beth Santis.
You can eat your soup with A, a fork, B, a spoon.
Yeah.
And they choose a fork.
They'll choose a fork every time. Every time.
They eat their peas with a knife. I mean,
Right. I don't understand it. I don't get it. And who does this appeal to? What kind of person do you have to be to say, oh, yeah, to look at these people and say that these are serious human beings who should be governing states or countries? I don't know.
Third base.
Yeah, right. Who? Who's on third?
Yeah, who? Third base, yeah. I mean, I kind of missed this when I was talking earlier. I have to admit that moron this DeSantis is not alone. There's always the guy in Texas. Hey, Abbott! Okay.
You have to be as old as us to have any idea what you're talking
about.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Those of you who do not understand, I'm really sorry about that. Okay, but from now on, his name is Hey Abbott! Okay. If you don't know who they are, just look up a thing called Who's On First. You'll understand 90% of our jokes. Okay,
yeah.
So, and you'll roll on the floor laughing, and you'll just say, gee, these guys are really old. Yeah, but they're funny.
They are.
So, I mean, they're people like that who just literally are leading us, and people are actually following like they're Pied Pipers. And we're the rats. And it just really is a sad play, and it comes back to, and I will repeat it just by not everything I have to say about it, but again, I will say this is just more evidence of the dumbing of America, literally the dumbing of America. And it just comes to the point where people just refuse to think for themselves. They want someone to think for them. You know, wake up. You know, and when I say wake up, I'm not just talking to those of you on the far right. I'm talking to everybody on the far left, too. Wake up. Grow up. Understand that the mass majority of the people in this country are in the middle. They don't demand everything now. They just want something, showing some action, doing something to make things better. And to build upon that. So I'm not just talking to the gun nuts. And I'm not talking to the QAnoners. I'm talking to people like who I talked about last week. This will go over real big in New York. AOC, her squad, and people who demand that they get everything now. When you ask for everything now, you don't get anything, because that's not the way most people think in this country. So take what you can get, shut your mouth, and keep moving forward. And to people on the far right, you know what? You have a brain. Use it. It's like the idiots who get arrested. I say this all the time to my students. You know, police officers sometimes look at defendants and say, you have a right to remain silent. Please use it. And then they talk. The defendant talks until they just feel this need to unburden themselves. Okay? You have a brain. Really, white matter, gray matter. You got all kinds of stuff up there, electricity running through your head. Okay? Allow it to direct itself into a place where something good is going to happen. You know, stop following people like DeSantis and Hey Abbott, okay? It's time to stop doing those things. It's time to start. You don't have the luxury, whether it's climate change or whether it's COVID or whether it is infrastructure, you don't have the time to play games anymore. The games have to end. And your constitutional rights, your minority viewpoints are just that, minority. Which brings us to another issue we were going to talk about. And that is the latest from Apple. Why don't you explain, Brendan, okay, why this is not as big a deal as everybody's making it out to be?
Well, you've studied this issue more than I have, but I think one of, and I think we've talked about this before on here, but it's again, this is another thing worth repeating. There seems to be, whether it comes to the issue you're talking about or the issues we've been talking about, like COVID, widespread misunderstanding about the Constitution and when it applies. The Constitution does not restrain or govern private conduct of a private person or a private entity. Jeff, you and I were talking earlier how hard it is sometimes to get this point across, because it seems to be ingrained in our culture, right? That if a radio station shuts you off, Sarah Palin used to say this all the time, right? Because radio stations would cut her off when she started lying about stuff. And she'd say that you're violating my First Amendment rights. Well, no, not so much. But again, it seems to be ingrained in our culture that if a store or an employer or, I don't know, a landlord or somebody like that does something to you, that they have violated your constitutional rights. And that simply isn't so. It's not to say that they haven't abused you or done something wrong or violated some law, but they haven't violated the Constitution because they can't. I was just talking to somebody from the media within the last couple of days about this, who was asking about a venue. It was a privately owned concert venue. That's now saying if you don't have proof of vaccination, you're not coming in to watch a concert here. So good for them. But of course, people are running around saying that violates my constitutional rights. So I'll repeat, right? But it's amazing how often you have to repeat this. A privately owned concert venue cannot violate your constitutional rights. In fact, private entities like that have constitutional rights. Right. It's not just that they can't violate yours, it's that they have their own.
They have First Amendment rights, just like people do.
Right, and associational rights. That's what I would say to set up your discussion. I know, because you know the technology part of what's going on here, but the point being, Apple is not a state actor, not a governmental actor, and cannot violate the Constitution. So why don't you take it from there? Because you were explaining this to me earlier this morning.
Yeah, first thing I want to say is, where were all of these people when they were yelling and screaming? Why weren't they yelling and screaming and objecting when Google was doing this type of thing and when Facebook was doing this kind of thing? And the way it works, as it was explained to me, is that a group of letters – that make up a specific image or word in binary code is called a hash. Thus, hashtag, get it? Hashtag. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is that Google and Facebook have been looking for child porn for years. Apple's just coming around to this because they have been bragging for years that they don't have the ability to break through encrypted messages. We now know that is not true. We know they were lying about that when they refused to help law enforcement in certain instances. And so, therefore, what happens is that their algorithm is set into a program in your iPhone and in your iPad and in your Mac or your MacBook Pro. It's built into their operating system. So all of you who have gotten the updates, that's what you got. That's part of what you got or what you're getting. is basically a program within their operating system that when you upload a picture or you put a picture into your phone, take a picture with your phone, and you have agreed to and operate under the basis that you use their iCloud, everything that you do in your Apple device goes into their iCloud. You can see this sometimes when you save things on your homepage, well, not homepage, but you know your desktop. And all of a sudden you see a little thing that looks like a cloud next to the name of what you've saved. That tells you you don't need to keep that on your desktop because it's in the cloud. And everything you're saving is going into the cloud. Well, when you send it to the cloud out of your phone or out of your computer, those hashes, that program has already recognized those hashes. And those hashes identify certain things that are synonymous with child pornography. And it alerts. And that's how this operates. They are a private platform. They do not violate your First Amendment rights. You don't want to do this, don't pay them their dollar a month. Don't allow your things to go into the cloud. But also remember, when you send out an email, they're going to see that go out. They're literally going to see those hashes go out. They don't actually see the image. They just see the data that makes the image. People say this is a slippery slope. Well, that slope has been going for a while now.
Yeah.
But they are not governmental agencies. There could come a time when they are mandated to report certain things that one could argue they are quasi-law enforcement. And when they become quasi-state actors, now your constitutional rights could be implicated. But right now it's not. And if you don't like what they're doing, then buy an Android. Now, the problem is that they operate on Google Chrome, which means what? Same thing's going to happen.
Right.
You could always just make telephone calls or send your pictures through the mail in hopes that, you know, they don't open up and everybody sees them. You got privacy rights in your mail. Be my guest. Send them through the mail. This is not going to implicate people who take pictures of their kids in a bathtub. I'm sorry. Or on a bearskin rug like they used to do. Okay? Cute little pictures. See, you want to see a picture of your fiancé when he was 6 months old and naked? Doesn't do anything for me, Mom. But But no, that's not what they're looking for. They've got an algorithm that has certain hashes which will disclose child pornography. And you know what? Apple even says, well, you really can't convert this type of technology to other things. That's not true either. They could. I'm not going to tell you they can't. They could. That was a lie. But to the same extent, this is costing Apple a lot of subscribers. It's going to cost them money, a lot of money. People will stop buying iPhones in the belief that because they're so expensive, they're safer. You spend $1,400 for an iPhone and you spend $400 for an Android phone. I mean, if you're not going to be any safer, why would you spend $1,400, right? So it's going to cost them money. Let's just face that reality. So they have a business interest in not expanding this program beyond this one particular thing. That's the education I got from reading a bunch of stuff about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so stop yelling and screaming. They're violating your First Amendment rights because, as Brendan put it, they what?
They can't.
Are not. Yes, they can't, and they won't, and they
right.
you know, they are not. Okay?
Right.
It's kind of that simple. So it was a subject that came up, and I thought you know, it was important to talk about.
Yeah.
Let's see what else we got here. Go ahead.
We got 5 minutes. You know, here's a good topic since you've been talking about Abbott this morning.
Abbott.
Hey.
Abbott. Okay.
Oh God. So.
Go ahead.
He and DeSantis have had one of their other hobbies when they're not busy getting people sick.
Hobby Lobby.
Is,
okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Another good group.
And another one of these, its own opposite things, right? Here's a question to ask Americans. It's a good idea if, A, we make it easier for more people to vote, or, B, we make it harder for people who are actually qualified to vote. And of course, Republicans have picked B for reasons we all know. But what's happened in Texas is Democrats, of course, have fled. They want to go home, by the way. But Democrats have fled from the state legislature so that this legislature can't reach the number of people it needs to do business. Governor Abbott has threatened to have these people detained and forcibly.
He's actually issued warrants.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, okay.
Right. And apparently yesterday, a state judge, and since you were one, I'm going to toss this over to you to see what you would have done under these circumstances. But a state judge had to issue a TRO. I say this every week. You can't make this stuff up. If you wrote this in a novel, nobody would buy it. Right. The governor's
literally
No, that's right. Literally. Wouldn't buy it.
Literally. Wouldn't buy
yeah.
it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Right. Nope. Not getting my $18 for that piece of trash. You got a governor running around saying he's going to arrest Democrats because they've walked out of the state legislature to stop the state legislature from enacting legislation that would take away people's right to vote. God forbid, right, when Democrats stand up for the right to vote. So now you have a state judge in Texas who had to issue a TRO, which is a temporary restraining order, against a bunch of people. Abbott, the Speaker of the House, the Sergeant at Arms, whoever else is involved in this, directing them that they are not allowed to take Democrats into custody. Jeff, you teach criminal procedure. Why don't you explain?
Okay, let me explain this. Okay, let me explain this to you, Lucy. It's kind of like this. I don't know where the authority comes for the governor of the state to issue a warrant for someone's arrest and detention. The only place they're allowed to do that is in extraditions under the Interstate Compact, which is a federal law, by the way, or... to put someone to death, which Abbott has done a lot of, okay?
Right.
That just isn't so. And it lacks the indicia of an arrest warrant being issued by a detached and neutral magistrate who determines that there is probable cause. And where no crime is committed, there can be no probable cause. And where they voluntarily absent themselves to not appear, there appears to be no ability to find them in contempt of the state senate or contempt of the state house, because there is literally no legal requirement that they appear. So these warrants that have been issued are just out and out a denial of due process. And they're unlawful. And apparently this was raised in front of a state judge and will continue to be litigated up the the steps to the state Supreme Court, at least in a very expedited manner, so that these people can go home and sit in their homes and be with their families, but just not go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a right not to go to work. Now, do they have the right to deny them their pay for the time that they're there? Sure. You don't get paid for doing nothing, unless you're a congressman or a senator. Okay. then you get paid everything for doing nothing. But you don't get paid for doing nothing. And that essentially is what is what's going to happen. And I don't think these legislators who have real jobs other than going there, and especially Democrats, and having to sit through being called names and being beat up on at every single session on every single issue, they're just choosing not to go to work. They'll go to their real jobs and make a living. And it'll be up to their voters to either recall them or deny them reelection. They have that choice. If they send them back and they choose not to go to work, they did it knowing they weren't going to go to work. And it just they just don't have the power to do what they're talking about. So the judge was right. Looking at it from that point of view, I would have done the same thing. And if it cost me my job because I'm elected – yeah, your time is up. Yeah, our time is up. Ding, ding, ding. Okay, got it.
Unfortunately.
Okay. What's the final Jeopardy answer? Okay. All right. We'll let you go. You got stuff to do. Have a great week. We'll see you next Tuesday. I'll be in North Carolina. I'll be calling from there.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
All the best.
All right. Take care, Brent.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye, Hezzy.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Brendan. Bye, Jeff. Bye. Okay, well, let's move on. We've got another guest, none other than Bill Cash. Bill Cash is a fly fisherman, and he is chasing something that I always, well, I've been told that I should write a book, but I haven't done it, but he's already begun. He's writing the upcoming 50 best tailwaters to fly fish. And I don't know how much longer it's going to take for him to finish it, but I raise my hat in honor of his unbelievable and difficult task. So good morning, Mr. Cash. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Hezzy. I have one small correction. The 50 Best Tailwaters for Fly Fishing is a book that's already been written. That was written by Wendy and Terry Gunn. And I'm just going through the book and trying to fish everything they wrote.
Oh, I see. So you're following in their footsteps in the water.
I am sort of, kind of. It's interesting. The editor of the book, Bennett Mintz, who put together this coalition of fly fishing destinations, he put it together and wrote this wonderful article, which you guys did feature. And it's about my journey across all the different states and tailwaters of the United States. I'm currently on number 27 out of 50.
God, that is amazing. Well, what was so compelling about the book, 50 Best Tailwaters to Fly Fish? What did it conjure up in you?
Well, yeah, as a child, I always had something by my nightstand, whether Field and Stream or outdoor magazines or something. And you just kind of look at that, and before you go to bed, you kind of dream about it. And so I purchased, when I retired, this book from my wife, 50 Tailwaters, 50 of the Best Tailwaters for Fly Fishing from Amazon. And I showed it to my buddy, and we started fishing some of the East Coast. And unfortunately, he moved to Colorado. And he said, you know what, why don't you come out here and fish the tailwaters out here? So my range of tailwaters suddenly expanded when I lost, you know, my best friend. And so each year since 2016, I take 3 weeks off and drive across the country and fish these tailwaters.
Very, very exciting. Well, what got you started in fly fishing, or was it this book? Where did you get Where did you get that interest? Did your dad do it?
No, my dad wasn't a fly fisherman. It was funny. My dad was an avid lake fisherman, and I was interested as a kid, about 12 or 15, and I got the typical fly tying kit and everything, probably back in the early 70s. And for a while I did it, but I wasn't that successful. So I put it away, and then kind of flash forward 20 years later, and I've got a daughter who's about 8 or 10, and we're in the garage up in my parents' camp in Lake Champlain, and she said, "What's this, Dad?" I said, "That's a fly rod." And I showed it to her, and she said, "This is neat." And I said, "I used to tie flies," and broke out the kit. We tied up some flies, and we caught a few sunfish. And she said, "I want to do that." So then we went to our local Trout Unlimited, and we took fly casting, fly fishing, and then fly tying courses. And it was about 2 decades ago, and I've been going strong ever since.
That's amazing. I do remember vaguely, but I don't even remember the name of the film. There was a film many, many years ago, probably over 20 years ago, maybe even 30, where there was a story about somebody who went fly fishing. And I was so blown away. It seemed like a lot of fun. And the most I ever did was I went fishing when I was very, very young and was in camp. And they took us to a lake, and we threw something into the water, and I was able to pull out a fish. I was, like, blown away. It was unbelievable. But I remember the feeling of it. And well, we threw the fish back into the water, and I've still been thinking about it ever since. So I'm a little bit guilty. I hope I didn't hurt the fish. So those are the problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't believe the fish that you're following. These are like monsters. My God, they are so big. It must be an unbelievable fight just pulling them in.
Well, the normal fish for trout throughout the country, and like I've said, I've been to 25 so far, or 26 so far. Normally, they range from 12 inches maybe to 20, 21, unless they're connected to a large lake system like we have in New York and the Salmon River and Plaski, and those are called migratory trout or migratory browns.
Yeah.
So this one that I caught, that was 27 inches long, the brown from Tennessee, was sort of an outlier. It was a really old fish, and I spoke to the wildlife biologist in the area, and it was the biggest one he's seen in decades. When I took a picture of the fish, I sent it to the author of the book, Terry Gunn, and Terry said, "This is a great fish. My editor wants to write a story," and that's Ben Mintz, and that's how we, discovered you guys. So it's sort of an outlier, but it happened right on my halfway through the book. So it's definitely a good omen.
Very, very exciting. And what was it that engendered your daughters to get involved in this?
We grew up in. I'm from the North Country up in Plattsburgh, and our family has this history of fishing and camping and scuba diving and sailing and cross-country skiing. And so we sort of threw everything at our daughters, my wife and I, and whatever stuck, whatever direction they wanted to go. It's ironic because my wife is from the Bronx. And not only did they get all this outdoor stuff, as we went to see lots of movies and radio shows and plays in the city, which scares me to death because I'm just afraid of the city. But my wife, again, being born in the Bronx, this is easy for her. So that's an interesting family.
So what is scary about the Bronx? That we don't have rivers to fish in? Is that the problem?
Oh, no. Again, I'm from Plattsburgh, New York, which is almost Canada, and I had never been to the city, New York City, much before. So it's just the amount of people and how do you get around. Being from a little small town and way up north, it's like, the scary stories of everybody in New York City is, going to be nasty to you, and it's just totally opposite of what's true, obviously. Wonderful opportunities to see the city, thanks to my wife.
And what was, did you move to Catskill, New York, for any particular reason? Did it have anything to do with fishing as well?
It did. I had an uncle, my uncle Jerry, Jerry Thompson, was moved from Catskill, New York, from his original birthplace up near Plattsburgh. And and I student taught in Catskill because, again, I like, you know, the fishing. I like the mountains. It was sort of the best of both worlds. You could go to the, you know, the Catskill Mountains, which are right next to you, and the Catskill. Catskill is the birthplace of fly fishing, and it was just a beautiful area.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
It was very fortunate.
And when you traveled around the country, is there a similarity to one venue as opposed to another? I mean, if you know your craft in Skill or in Plattsburgh, does that correlate well to maybe the Colorado or Texas or California?
Yeah, that's a great question. Originally, you think it would correlate, but the fun thing about doing this whole fly fishing bit, especially for me and my best friend Marty, is we're fly tires too. So it's not only a study of how to get there and accommodations and everything else, it's a study of what's the entomology like, what are the bugs like. And you have to know a little bit of Latin, you have to know what the bugs are. And one particular species, Trico, are really tiny in the east, but out west they're really big, and they will not bite on the tiny flies. So you have to know what's going to hatch, where is it going to hatch, where is it in the water column? Is it on the surface? Is it in the middle? Is it at the bottom? So you have to do all this research, and I love to drive versus fly because I like to see the places, but I bring all this fly tying equipment with me and all these hatch charts and different things, and then if we're not having good luck on one fly, we'll look up a hatch chart or we'll see something and we'll tie something up in these cabins at night. And that's kind of the fun. It's putting it together. It's a puzzle. It's similar, but it's not the same, and that's the challenge.
So, and how do you learn to do all of that? That's very complex, isn't it? I mean, they're very elaborate. I've seen some of those. They're unbelievable. I had no idea it took that much effort and study either. I mean, I feel like totally ignorant. My God. I mean, where have I been my whole life? I have no idea.
Well, it just takes a while. I was fortunate that we had a good Trout Unlimited chapter in Catskill years ago. Unfortunately, that chapter is kind of, isn't available in Catskill. But that's where my daughter and I went, and they introduced us to the Catskill, flies. And then you just read, and you have stuff by your nightstand, and you talk to people. And fly fishermen are really a pretty unique group because if you're not catching something, you can ask somebody, the guy next to you, what are you using? And he'll tell you. And if you don't have that fly, 9 times out of 10, he'll give it to you. Because 90%, probably 95% of the fishermen are catch and release. And so there's no competition. So it's kind of a fun thing to do.
That's beautiful. So this is a very tight-knit group of people. And you travel all over the world. And I guess you have to be very gregarious, don't you?
You do.
It seems like it would be a lonely place in the river, but not necessarily.
No, it's not. And sometimes you have these memorable moments of certain people and certain episodes that just, you look back at it and you say, wow, that was really unique. For instance, I was fishing in one tailwater in Massachusetts with my daughter when she was younger, and there was an older guy in his mid-80s, and Bill was his name, phenomenal fisherman, kind of a grouchy old guy. So it's a bunch of fishermen around, and nobody's catching anything except Bill. And so he sees me fishing with my daughter, and he calls my daughter over, hey, you come over here. And he puts his fly on her line. All of a sudden, she's catching fish. So they're both catching fish, and I asked Bill, do you have any more of those flies? And he said, no. I know Bill had more of those flies, but he didn't want to give any out. And when we were done fishing at night and, everybody's going back out to the car, I said to Bill, what type of fly is that? He said, did you notice those little green caterpillars walking on the way into this, to the fishing place? I said, no. Yeah. He says, yeah, I know you didn't. He says, it's a green caterpillar fly.
Oh, my gosh.
So
that's amazing.
just an older fella, really observant, really a good entomologist, and he just chuckled because he wanted to see my daughter catch fish and me not, and he had such a laugh over that. Yeah. But certain moments stick out, and you remember those stories forever.
It sounds very complex, and yet seemingly simple, but, you know, what you're explaining to me is a complexity that is really very interesting, and I could see myself engaged in something like that. I don't live in an area where we have too many rivers, so, but it sounds like it should be a lot of fun, really. And I had no idea it was so cerebral as well.
Well, it can be if you like to go with that routine, if you like, you know, if you like that. The other thing, it's crafty too. It's making your own flies, and there's something magical about, you know, a little fur, a little thread, a little feather, and then tying it together and going out and catching a fish. It's kind of magical.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, did other fishermen teach you how to create, you know, one of these lures?
All the time, yeah, you know, and
all the time.
When I first started, you know, we didn't have YouTube, but with YouTube, and there's all sorts of fly fishing groups. Matter of fact, when I was, you know, going to the Clinch River where I caught that big brown, I'm in a group called the Catskill Fly Fishing Association. So yeah. I just said, anybody know a good guide? And they recommended this gentleman, and and that's when I had such wonderful luck.
That's fascinating.
It's a really nice community, and like I said, it's not a competitive community, and the flies that they tie are amazing. Some are realistic, some are attractor flies, something that's not in nature that attracts fish. Some are realistic, you know, flies, and some imitate minnows, some imitate frogs. It's pretty unique, but it doesn't have to be technical, because you can buy your own things and you can make it simple. But if you like puzzles and you like figuring stuff out.
It sounds like that's very, very interesting. So it's almost as if you become one with a fish and a particular fish at that. So does YouTube and give you instructions as well that way?
They do.
They're available maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
YouTube is wonderful. So it's, again, a little bit of research. You know, my next day of water that I go to, I look up what the hatch chart is, and the entomologists say what the hatch chart is, and then from there you go to YouTube and you say, how do I tie this insect? And you'll end up with 20 or 30 videos of it, you know, and then you.
Beautiful.
I always cross-reference with the local fly shops in the area and see what they have. And sometimes what I'll do is I will. I love tying my own, but I'm not enamored to them. So sometimes I'll say, can you send me, you know, 5 of your best flies for fishing one certain insect? They'll mail it to me months in advance, and then I'll just tie, you know, maybe a dozen of those flies before I go to that trip.
So unbelievable.
It makes it fun.
Has the entourage of fly fishermen in your family expanded beyond that? Do you know other people that, you know, love this sport?
Oh, in my family? My cousin John.
Yeah, beyond your family.
Oh, beyond my family. Well, that's
family,
that's my best.
Well, as beyond.
Yeah, I've got a couple fishing partners that around the area, but the gentleman I do the most with is lives in Colorado. He's a state director for invasive species in Colorado, and he's an avid fly fisherman. And so that's sort of my fishing buddy. I do probably about 80 to 90% of all these tailwaters with him.
It's amazing. That is really amazing.
It's a unique story. Martin Lowney, when I originally met Martin decades ago, it was he was just an intermediate fly fisherman, and you know, I had much more experience, so I sort of taught him fly fishing. But being from the North Country, I never fished out of New York State. Again, afraid to drive places, getting lost, and he introduced me to a GPS. And once I had a GPS in my car, I've been doing all these destinations.
So technology has moved you ahead of the curve. That is really fascinating.
It really has. It's I don't know if you remember the days of when you went on a big trip, you would print things out on you know, on the computer on dot matrix, and then you have to try to read how to get home on the reversal at night with a flashlight. And it's you know, and when GPSs came out, he said you got to get a GPS because your sense of direction isn't that good.
Yeah, mine definitely is not. So so that's something to think about. And this is very, very unique because your relationship with your daughters, so your family is very, very tight, it seems. And it's a wonderful foundation, the fly fishing, but it must also help in, you know, maintaining the relationship. So you guys are very, very tight. And what a great way to come together.
It is. We're really lucky. It's, again, growing up in the North Country, we did a lot of these activities with my parents. Both my sister and I did, and she did a lot of things too. And her boys, one is a charter boat captain in South Carolina, and the other is paints down there. He owns a painting company, but they're both avid fishermen. And my sister fishes, you know, multiple times per month, and you know, it's a really tight knit family.
It sounds beautiful. It's amazing that you know, fly fishing, you know, is cements part of who you are, and that's really very fascinating. So when Mr. Mintz wrote this book, you're also, you know, you have a wonderful entourage of people that you know and relatives all over the country. That has to be very, very exciting. Did you plan on this before you retired? Did you know this was where you were going to go, or was this like something, a new discovery for you?
Well, it was kind of making the best out of the worst situation. You know, in 2014 and 2015, I lost both my parents, you know, and...
oh, my God.
It's one of those things, you know. They went one after another. And then in 2015, my best friend, Marty, moved out to Colorado, you know, and that's just the guy that he did tons of fishing with. And it was another loss until he said, you need to come out here and fish. And it's like, okay, is this a loss or is this an opportunity? You know, so... So while I had done some things in the book, you know, once I started going to Colorado, all of a sudden it's like I've done all the ones in the east. I've done all the ones, you know, three quarters of the ones in the west. And then my youngest daughter, Kate Cash, she moved down to Asheville, North Carolina, and became a mountain hiking guide.
Really?
And that's where she lives now. So, and she loves the mountains down there, and has done the, you know, Pacific Crest Trail and the Appalachian Trail, and so we go visit her. So, in
that's
the southern tailwaters, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And so when we go down there, I always take a day or two, and you know, I open up the book, which is on my nightstand, and say, okay, I'm visiting Kate. What's available to fish down the area?
That is terrific. Really terrific. Because you lived in Plattsburgh, do you also fish near the Canadian border, or do you cross into Canada?
I haven't fished into Canada much. That would be a possibility. That would be a possibility in the future. Most of this book has been in the United States. I haven't fished in Canada much. There's some things I always would like to do. There's a couple of dream spots. Canada has some wonderful brook trout fishing. That's sort of on the list of things to do. There's certain things. But I also found that same species, brook trout, in the Rapid River in Maine, and that was a wonderful trip.
Mm.
I saw 21 moose when I was up there.
I absolutely adore Maine. You know, I would have moved up to Maine except I had a lot of cardiac issues, so it was too far away. You know, I didn't want to live in Portland. You know, it's just like, oh, that's another big city. But so I was looking for something a little bit simpler than that, but I needed to be near a hospital. So it's very, very interesting. But what a beautiful, the state of mind. That's what Maine is, and it's just breathtaking. Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow.
Feel very fortunate because it's the Albany, the capital district of New York. It's I'm close to, you know, close enough to Maine that I can get to Maine in a couple hours. I can go down to New York City and see a show. I can go to the Catskill Mountains, and the fishery that we have over by the Great Lakes is wonderful for fly fishing, you know, the various streams and that. Lucky to be, you know, where I'm at. Very fortunate.
How do you learn to fly fish? Where did you learn it? What do you need to know?
A
not
little
like
bit
you're dropping
my,
a lure into the water and waiting. So
a little bit from my dad. He knew the basics, and then just reading books in high school. But I wasn't that successful at it. The best way that I learned was from the Trout Unlimited. And I think it was during the winter time. We spent one winter the whole winter fly casting with them, learning how to fly cast. And then how they took us out stalking, and a couple of gentlemen took us out fishing. And then the next winter, we learned how to tie flies with them. You know, they had a fly tying thing over the winter. Which is great fun because the winters sometimes can be tough.
Yeah. This is really interesting. It's so beautiful. It seems like such a complexity, and people probably think it's very simple, but it's not. I like that it's cerebral as well and, you know, physical also. So it's amazing how you tie so much of you know, your humanity together with a sport and, you know, mentally and physically. And also, you know, family structure. It's beautiful. You know, did you contemplate that in advance, or just happened?
I think it just sort of happened. It's funny thing that the journey that you go on when you have children. It's both my wife and I are in the philosophy of throw everything at them and see what sticks. And you never know. It's my youngest, Kate, who's done a lot of guiding in New York and Vermont and, you know, for climbing mountains and in Asheville. Originally, she didn't like camping and hiking at all, but she liked snacks, and her older sister liked camping. Who would have guessed that she would have done that? So it's we just kind of threw a lot at them, and sometimes their interests change. Ironically, Kate was also very good in music, and so she got a scholarship to musical theater to Russell Sage, and that's where she started. And then after she finished college, she did a stint on the Appalachian Trail and fell in love with that lifestyle. Sometimes life happens and gets in the way of your plans, which is really fun.
It is. It is. Life is an adventure. If you keep your eyes open, it's really terrific.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's like that old timer saying, just look for the green caterpillars.
You got it. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, I can't believe it. Time is gone so quickly. I didn't frighten you, and I hope that you'll consider coming back again. You know, we're on all the time. And what a pleasure to meet you. You know, it's just really terrific. I'm so thrilled that you made the time for our broadcast. What a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. It was great talking with you, and I love your enthusiasm. Great questions. That was fun. And definitely I would love to come back. I'll give you an update where I'm at some point.
That would be really great. And then thank you for making me understand the correction.
No problem at all.
I have to. So I should be able to look up 50 best tail waters
for
fly fish. And that's the
by
book. So I
Terry
can
Gunn.
Link that. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I'll be able to link that to so to update what we wrote before, so that
that'd
it becomes
be
a reality. People want to pick up the book. Very,
mm-hmm.
very good. Thank you again, Mr. Cash. It's been a pleasure. All the best.
Oh, it's
to
been
you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot now.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well, there we have it, folks, none other than Bill Cash. He's following the trail of the 50 best tailwaters to fly fish, and then try to update this so that you'll be able to have access to the book by linking on to it. Really, really fascinating. All right. Well, let's just see what else is happening in our neck of the woods. Bear with me a moment here. 1 second. All right, so 1 second. There's so many pages that I've got open here. Sometimes get befuddled by all of that. All right, so this is not an issue. Okay. All right, so let's move on first to... Okay, moving on to the website, the YoungChristTribune.com website. And let's see, let's move in here. I wanted to read something to you because we've been getting some very interesting comments on the website. I'm going to go over that with you. So I wrote an editorial about it, and I think you'll find it interesting. Bear with me a moment here. Okay, let's see if we can get this. Sorry about that. Where are we here? For some reason, there it is. It's now pulled up. I tell you, I don't know what's been happening of late, but the last few months is a weird situation that are happening on the internet. Now you press a button and you do this and you do that and follow something that I've known for years, and all of a sudden it doesn't work. Oh, it's become havoc at times, and I don't know what the issues are. And I think there's I believe there's been hacking going on, and I'm not quite sure exactly what is or what isn't. Well, let's see, tomorrow is Wednesday. I hope you'll consider reading the latest article by Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He's a socioeconomic research scholar, and the title of his most recent essay is "Violating the Constitution Does Not Protect, quote, Our Democracy," end quote. And that's by Oren M. Levin-Waldman. You'll find it a fascinating read, and we'll be discussing it tomorrow from 10 o'clock in the morning. To 11. There's great depth and just fascinating dissertation in his essays, which are so well expressed, which is really, really fascinating. Yeah, I see that there's a slow uptake today. Just so you know, we did get notice from on the local scene. Bear with me a moment. That's why it seems to be taking longer than expected. The Westchester County Health Department has issued a heat advisory. This notice came to us from David Tubiolo, who is a Westchester County Board legislator representing the city of Yonkers as well as the city of Mount Vernon. And so the heat wave is expected to hit Westchester County today, all the way through Friday, with temperatures ranging from the mid-90s to 105 degrees, humidity making it feel even hotter than the thermometer reads. And these heat wave conditions could last into Saturday. And with such high temperatures expected, the Westchester County Health Department is issuing a heat advisory. As humidity and temperatures rise, residents should avoid strenuous activity. Drink lots of water, avoid alcohol and caffeine, and cool off to prevent heat-related illnesses. Now, This is also on Espanol, El Departamento de Salud del Condado de Westchester emite un aviso de calor. So you could read that in Spanish as well. I hope I didn't butcher the Spanish, because I don't speak Spanish, but speak seven languages, but I don't speak Spanish. Go figure that one. Where the hell have I been, and what? Why did I learn all those other languages? But that's another story. We'll talk about that at another time. Okay, so let's look at something else here. Bear with me a moment. I wanted to read this to you, which I hope you'll find salient, and it's entitled Politics. Permission neither requested nor granted, and it's written by Nehaz Yaris. So this is what we call the hezitorial. My name is Hezi. So somebody came up, one of our readers came up with the idea, said, well, why don't you call it a hezitorial instead of an editorial? So I said, well, that sounds pretty good. So I was like enamored. So everything that is an editorial is now called the hezitorial. And this one is Truth is the Child of Time. And that will be made clear after we finish reading this. Politics begins at inception. It is a reality imposed, neither requested or granted. It lives within and without us, whether we are aloof or engaged. No matter the posture we take, we are participants throughout our lives and by every measure and dimension in the world of politics. Even when we claim to be estranged, we are instead tethered to the political realm which we inhabit begrudgingly or with fervor. Political dogma may captivate or intrude into what we believe is our free will. A political construct is first conceived in the womb. It is there that a yin-yang relationship between mother and child begins. The nuclear family structure sustains and exemplifies the nurturing political structure of the home. And from there, it continues throughout the different grades of schooling. In time, it repeats itself through another union. All the while, people do not seem to recognize that they have always been part of the political world they inhabit. No matter the gender, sexual preference, ethnicity, language, culture, or nation, we are part of a cycle that begins within a nurturing environment. And thereafter, it evolves into the nuclear family, sometimes a better environment, sometimes not. Graduating over time from conception to infancy, childhood, higher learning, adulthood, relationships or relationship, employment, retirement, and eventual death, politics is how we were conceived, how we learned, what we made of our lives until our time runs out. Now, the First World War, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War followed a political timeline to be supported by some and was the consternation among others. The repetitiveness of such horror eventually brought about a society that asserted that they would divorce the reality, even stopping to read the news, listen to news on radio or on television. The concept of shutting out the world was laudable at best, but proven unsustainable. Politics has grabbed us by the throat and never let go. We could deny we were independent of the world we lived, but deep down we had to know we were not living on a physical or mental island. Over time, those who claimed otherwise were in fact part of the system they claimed they were not. The dynamic seemed what was first espoused, but we were proven wrong. Some did not vote, permitting others to define their lot in life emotionally, financially, dogmatically, and in time, people would come to recognize that we were either dismissed as participants in our present and future lives, or we could have a voice in our individual and collective outcome. Some would use the political system to coerce their view upon others. Others submitted to the political structure, while others were still to grasp that they were involved whether they realized it or not. And those who voted, no matter their perspective or perspectives gain prowess in their chosen political collective. One could choose one political party or another or claim a lack of alliance with others, but getting no advancement in life's riches. While conception is recognized, the evolving stages of life are often overlooked. Politics often blinds us and deflects us from what is best for us, but only if we are divorced from the community within which we reside. More than ever, I have found that an adversarial demeanor, devoid of explanation and validity, rules the day. It is as if the explanation is not warranted. While it may be simpler to opine without validation, it is an impotent approach, and that is simply because respectful discourse has deteriorated into finger-pointing for one reason or another, while all that is required is telling it as it is understood. Well, agreement may be a nice outcome, but the discourse is of greater relevance because it reveals who we are. Adversarial postulations cannot and do not rationalize any perspective to those who see or believe a different reality. It is by these measures that everyone in politics today is blamed for every deleterious outcome. The assertion is that they are not independent, that they are sycophants who take orders. No matter the societal framework, there is an inescapable hierarchical dynamic. Define the system as you like, whether communism, democracy, fascism, Nazism, socialism, etc., each has a hierarchical process and procedure to elevate those within its fold, often referred to as a family and friends network. It is a process constructed by men/women that traces its roots to the dynamics of relationships as described above herein. Now, interestingly, when society is discomforted by those at the helm, the only solution is the political dynamic. One vote can be the difference between change or continuation of those ensconced in the offices of power. The vote for Mount Vernon City Council underwent a review of the vote, and it was recognized that Mount Vernon City Council member-elect Caitlin Gleason had won by 2 votes. Imagine that. Those engaged in this election made a difference that is expected to better define the city of Mount Vernon. While there are many who are regarded as naysayers, some vote while others do not. In Ms. Gleason's case, her backers created a change not even contemplated months ago as the election process began in earnest. And these 2 votes mattered. In fact, every vote matters. Some votes are cast for the prospect of change to the status quo. The initiative and the outcome was revealed by the voter. Yet there is a failing, and that failing is that those in office or will soon be in office do not communicate with the people who voted them into office. If the voters are not made privy to what is being done upon their behalf, the likelihood of being reelected for another term wanes. The responsibility of the voter is to be heard. Making an appointment with an elected official, calling them on the phone, writing a letter to the editor, among other means are necessary to being heard and recognized. Now you know that, quote, truth is the child of time, end quote. The takeaway is simply evolve the lessons of childhood or adopt the concepts of governance and engagement in a new land or find oneself dismissed by a system that cannot recognize those who do not cast their vote. Well, houses of worship do not espouse supporting one candidate over another, but they can inform congregants to the issues at hand in a multitude of languages. Residents must demand answers emboldened by neighborhood associations and support from elected officials. This editorial is strictly meant to reveal the process rather than to espouse the election of one individual or another. And, and then another thing, this is a special note that we posted here. In order for people to respect the subject matters that we write about. So the note is as follows. Those who care to share their thoughts are advised that a lack of explanation of your perspective, or if the comment does not conform to the subject noted herein, will be trashed. You heard that right. It will be trashed. The purpose of the Yonkers Tribune has been and remains a forum of ideas and ideals. If you do not care for a candidate or to explain their failing, anything less will be expunged. Since we cannot validate the name of those commenting, please do not sign your name to any comment, as we learned years ago that some people named were not the authors. So we do not accept names. If you have a subject you want discussed, please share your thoughts, and I will create an article to engage in the subject matter you want noted, and direct your email to whyteditor@gmail.com. So hopefully that informs you to a good extent. And because you know what happens, the reason this is pertinent is because you've got a lot of people who don't even pay attention to the subject matter at hand. They just get on the site, comment on something that is totally unrelated to the subject matter. And what that really does, I don't know if it's intended, but I get the impression that it is. It's intentional to malign the discussion and to cause it to veer off the subject matter being discussed. Whether you respect what we do or whether you don't respect what we do, I hope you recognize that we have a perspective, and that we are open, and when we discuss issues, they are intended to create a discussion and to shake some issues, and reveal what they mean and how we got there. And so whatever the issue is, there is nothing that I don't have the capacity to write about. I may not be able to write about it instantly, but I will be able to write about it. I've got enough of an educational background to probably cover almost every conceivable subject you can come up with. So that's the story. Now, let's just see what else is happening here. Let me quickly look to see. Where are we here? One second. I think you'll find this really fascinating. I certainly did. A Yonkersite by the name of Aidan Connolly is also an Iona College junior, and he spreads a smile awareness on cross-U.S. bike trek raising money for disabled people. So on August 9 of 2021, Aidan Connolly initially doubted what he and his fraternity brothers could accomplish by biking across the United States to raise money for disabled people. Well, the possibilities dawned on the Iona Junior as he cycled from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. as part of the Journey of Hope, the Ability Experience. And after sharing meals and good times with disabled people across the country, he now understands that their 62-day trek is about more than the $175,000 he and his 25 teammates have raised so far. Quote, "This is way, way bigger than just me. We're cycling because we're trying to bring hope and celebrate the abilities of all people," said Connolly, who's only 20 years old, who is pursuing a dual degree in economics and business administration in entrepreneurship at the Iona College based in New Rochelle. Well, Connolly is a Yonkers native, learned about Journey of Hope through its fraternity, Pi Kappa Phi, which launched the ride in 1988 as a philanthropic initiative. The Journey of Hope's goal is to establish volunteer relationships with facilities that serve people with disabilities. Connolly and his fraternity brothers from throughout the United States expect to arrive in Washington, D.C. on August 14 via two routes. Connolly is on the northern route, and he typically rides all day, stopping at centers that host him and his brothers for overnight visits. Collectively, the riders on the north and south routes have raised more than $300,000. While at the hosting sites, the bicyclists participate in activities with disabled people from the local communities. Often, there are parties at the friendship visits. Quote, at one of our first visits, we had participants waiting for us at the Elks Lodge. We do dance parties, bring a smile on someone's face, and create a memory. Sometimes we play games with them or dine together, said Connolly during a rest stop in Grand Island, Nebraska. Along the way, Connolly has learned lessons about biking and his body's limits. He got food poisoning in Colorado and viral tonsillitis, both unusual ailments for the Journey of Hope cruise. Cycling on flat ground in New York didn't prepare me to climb mountains like the Rockies, he said, on the first third of his journey. Connolly also learned about the transformative power that every individual possesses. Quote, one person can make a difference, he said. Life is really too short to take things for granted, to complain. You should really try to stay positive and count your blessings every day because you never know what tomorrow will bring. Once in the District of Columbia, Connolly will take a long break from biking, but he's not giving up long-distance adventures. Moving forward, I know that I and a lot of the guys here are thinking of riding our bikes across Japan or across Europe and continue our efforts to raise money and awareness for people with disabilities and celebrate people of all abilities, he said. This trip has truly taught me that anything and everything is possible with a glimmer of hope. Really wonderful, wonderful attitude, but really terrific. One second. Now let's quickly look. Bear with me a moment. Okay. All right. Well, there are other issues, of course, that we've covered on the website. There's a Canadian church hate, which comes for Coptic Christians. The Battle of Jaffa, when 2,000 knights defeated 20,000 Muslims. We've also got an article about Assemblyman Sayers, who calls on the Governor Cuomo to resign for the good of the state. And we've got some news and notes from the northern part of the county. So that's always exciting. Yes, and there's an article about a statement from the Attorney General's office following Albany Sheriff's press conference. One second, let me just see what else we've got. And then probably the most compelling thing is that we'll be discussing tomorrow, 10 a.m., is an article, an essay written by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, socioeconomic research scholar, which is entitled Violating the Constitution Does Not Protect, quote, Our Democracy, end quote. So I hopefully you'll appreciate that. It's always a wonderful discussion with him. It's absolutely brilliant. And he sees things that I think most people, including myself, don't recognize, but they're there. You just have to be focused in on it. and his discipline and is such that he's able to see what's out there, which is really fascinating. Okay, let's quickly look to see something. I don't have too much time on the international stage. This is really very interesting. Evidently, the Marburg virus has been discovered, also the Marburg virus is Ebola's deadly cousin. Let me just see, which I think you'll find fascinating. Guinea has recorded the first known case of Marburg virus, a lethal cousin to Ebola, the United Nations World Health Organization, or WHO, has said. And here's a factoid on the disease. The source is the World Health Organization, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So what is Marburg? Marburg virus is a highly dangerous pathogen that causes hemorrhagic fever. According to past outbreaks, the average fatality rate is 50% in a range of 24% to 88%. The virus is part of the so-called filovirus or filovirus family, to which the Ebola virus also belongs. It takes the name from the German city of Marburg, where it was first in 1967 in a lab, where workers had been in contact with infected green monkeys that had been imported from Uganda in Africa. Two other outbreaks occurred in the same time in Frankfurt, also in Germany, and in Belgrade, in Bulgaria, then the capital of Yugoslavia, and now it's Serbia. So Belgrade is in former Yugoslavia, now Serbia, and then seven people had died. So the question is, how is it transmitted? The natural reservoir or host of the Marburg virus is the African fruit bat. The cave-dwelling mammals carry the virus but do not fall sick from it and can hand the virus to the primates in close proximity, including humans. One suspected pathway is the killing of, or butchering of infected bats for food. Human-to-human transmission then occurs through contact with blood or other bodily fluids or contact with surfaces such as bedding or clothing that are contaminated with these fluids. And some infections have happened accidentally in the lab through needle wounds. So what are the symptoms? The virus takes between 2 and 21 days to incubate, leading to abrupt symptoms of high fever, severe headaches, muscular pain, vomiting, and diarrhea, symptoms that can make Marburg difficult to diagnose initially, as they are similar to diseases such as typhoid and malaria. Hemorrhagic episodes typically follow between 5 and 7 days later, with blood in the vomit and feces and bleeding from the nose, gums, and vagina. In fatal cases, death occurs most often between 8 and 9 days. There are no vaccines or antiviral treatments for Marburg disease at the moment. However, rehydration with oral or intravenous techniques have improved survival, and experimental use of monoclonal antibody drugs have been promising. This is why it's crucial to stamp out the disease from the outset, say experts. Quote, you have to step up surveillance, identify all contact cases in order to isolate them if they start developing the disease to prevent any transmission, said Ousmane Faye, a virologist at the Pasteur Institute in Dakar, Senegal, which is the capital of Senegal. Well, so that's what it is. And the single case that has so far been detected in Guinea occurred in a village in the district of Guédou in a forested region in the south of the country close to the border with Sierra Leone and Liberia. The patient's a man who died on August 2nd after developing symptoms on July 25. Three of his relatives and a health worker have been identified as being at high risk and are under close surveillance. Around 150 others considered contact cases are also monitored daily, and the country
has also stepped up cross-border vigilance. So that's the story at the moment. We're going to need to go back to our studio screen. Bear with me a moment. And we're going to need to say goodbye. Bear with me one more second, because there we are. So we'll speak to you tomorrow, and thank you for being with us today. Goodbye.